Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin on this Labor Day with an assessment of what is driving the growing income and opportunity gap in America as our democracy is increasingly captured by plutocrats. Chuck Collins, the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires, and the author of Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good, joins us to discuss his new report at the Next System Project, Reversing Inequality, Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. We will look into the growing divide that is not so much the result of technological change and globalization, but is embedded in our economic and political system, since we have reached the point where the top 1/10 of 1% own as much as the bottom 90% of U.S. households combined. Then we'll explore the reasons why union representation in the private sector has shrunk to below 7% compared to 35% in the 1950s, and why it has been attributed to American workers turning away from unions rather than the real cause, which is the hidden war against unions by the multi-billion dollar union-busting industry financed by the Koch brothers and other billionaires. Sylvia Allegretto, a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley, joins us to discuss the judiciary as an arm of the union-busting industry, with corporatist judges like Neil Gorsuch now poised to eviscerate public sector unions. Then finally, we'll speak with Sam Pizzagatti, a veteran labor journalist and author of The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class, who has an article at inequality.org, A Hall of Fame Turns Shameful. We will discuss how the portrait of the union-busting President Reagan has been put up in the Labor Department's Hall of Fame alongside true heroes of labor like Cesar Chavez by Labor Secretary Acosta, who was appointed by Trump because of his hostility to American workers. And joining us on this Labor Day is Chuck Collins, who is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good, as well as being the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. He is the co-author of several books, including Economic Apartheid in America, a primer on economic inequality and insecurity, The Moral Measure of the Economy, and Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. His latest book is Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And he has a new study at the Next Systems Project, Reversing Inequality and Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chuck Collins.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Chuck. And I must say, watching the tragic pictures unfold down there in Houston, you do see a kind of apartheid in America between the wealthy and the poor. Not that the flood didn't also flood some wealthy homes, but we know that they've got insurance and that most of the people that were flooded out don't. And then the more that I've looked into it with people that live down there and specialists on coastal wetlands, etc., there's this chemical coast that they call it, where all of these chemical oil and gas infrastructure, it's also known as Cancer Alley. Much of that, of course, has been inundated by water, and all the pollutants are now swirling around in this toxic stew. But then when you look into the government of Texas, how they enabled these big oil and chemical companies to build plants in suburban neighborhoods, and the governor, Abbott, who casts himself as a good Christian, one of his first acts was to rescind the requirement for corporations, particularly those with dangerous chemicals, to make public the inventory of what they had on site. And of course, even as this plant's burning in Crosby, Texas, nobody knows what's about to explode because they're no longer required to do that. And Governor Abbott, before he made that decision after a fertilizer plant blew up in 2013, he took a whole bunch of money from the Koch brothers. And thus we have the results. So I'm beginning to see, at least in the state of Texas, a fairly clear example of a government that takes care of business and puts profit over people. How bad is that model? I mean, are we heading in that direction?
Yeah, I think, Ian, you described the toxic brew of growing inequality and our kind of ecological catastrophe in unfolding. I mean, it's very similar to Louisiana, where, you know, upstream from New Orleans, you have another cancer alley and the petrochemical industry. These are like petrol democracies or petrol dictatorships, where the government is really captured by the fossil fuel industry. It gets its way, and so when there is an ecological crisis like a mass hurricane, it really peels back kind of that intersection of plutocracy, kind of authoritarian politics and inequality, and the people who are suffering the most are the most vulnerable and the most low income and often communities of color, both in Texas and in Louisiana. You see that happening right before our eyes.
And of course, Governor Abbott is also one of the state governors that are pushing President Trump into rescinding the DACA agreement made under President Obama. And of course, everything that Obama did, Trump, he feels compelled to undo. But that could cause enormous amount of human suffering. You've got 800,000 kids with brothers and sisters and parents and friends that they could all be deported in a national trauma. So there's a kind of cruel streak going on here in our country, it seems.
Yeah, and yet at the same time, you kind of see the seeds of resistance in that. I mean, you know, they tried to reform a healthcare, and when it became clear that there were real human beings that were going to be affected by this sort of abstract ideology of theirs, that things kind of folded. And I think with DACA, you can't imagine. I mean, these are leading light young people in many communities. They are known individuals. They're hogging the honor rolls in their schools, and to sort of lead to their, you know, being kicked out of school or deportation is going to just tear communities apart. But I don't think people are going to put up with it. I actually think this is sort of like how far can you go down the line before people just say enough is enough? And I think each time we're kind of bumping up against these trip points where I think people are just going to be like, I can't believe this is what's going on, if there were deportations of the DACA students.
And again, I'm speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He's also the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and The Patriotic Millionaires. And his books include Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. And his latest book is Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home and Committing to the Common Good. And he has a new study at the Next System Project, Reversing Inequality, Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. So on this Labor Day, let's talk a little bit about your study, which is very, very comprehensive and very deep. But just to sort of encapsulate some of it, what you're saying is, for starters, we must know what we are up against. These inequalities do not spring mainly from technological change and globalization, though both compound and complicate the rift. Instead, imbalances of power and agency embedded in our political and economic systems are the main drivers and accelerators of inequality. So, in a nutshell, could you make the case that because we have money-driven politics, he who has the most money owns our politics? Is that at the heart of it, you know, in a simplistic sense?
Yeah, it's partly there's this cycle between, you know, kind of a corrupt governing system or a political system that's been captured now by big money. But what that leads to is the changes in the rules that govern the economy. So even if we sort of today cleaned up government, the rules of the economy, tax policy, trade policies, government spending priorities, just left on autopilot, would create greater and greater inequalities. So we need to reverse not only that sort of power imbalance, but we also have to change the rules to build a more of a shared prosperity economy. And, you know, the reason I wrote that study is because people are recognizing these inequalities, but they're proposing kind of milquetoast solutions. Oh, well, let's just invest in education, and that'll enable young people to kind of get into the market and compete. And it's just much more complicated than that now because of this unwieldy concentration of wealth and power that we're having to deal with.
So what is the, is it something inexorable, or is there a plan here? In other words, why would you want a country in which the billionaires, as you point out, I'll just read a little bit here to get some context. At the very pinnacle of U.S. wealth is the Forbes 400. Billionaires whose combined net worth totals $2.3 trillion. Together, this small group has more wealth than the bottom 61% of the U.S. population combined. The richest 100 have more wealth than the entire black population, over 14 million households. And the net worth of the wealthiest 20 billionaires, all of whom could sit in one Gulfstream 650 luxury jet, exceeds that of the bottom half of the U.S. population combined. So that, of course, really does give you a picture of the extraordinary excess. And as your co-author of the book Wealth in Our Commonwealth, Bill Gates Sr. once said, you can't sail two yachts at the same time. So what is driving this lust for obscene amounts of wealth?
Well, probably the first stage of inequality that we lived through sort of prior to 2000 was driven by, you know, CEOs taking more of the profits. Now, though, what we're seeing is wealth creating more wealth at an accelerating speed at the top. So the driving forces are almost sort of baked now into the economy. And that's one of the challenges. And I think, though, that the good news is that this is creating, the conditions for a political realignment. We've already lived through an election that was primarily about inequality, where there was a sort of populist uprising, whether it was going toward a Bernie Sanders populism or a regressive Donald Trump populism. But that's all being driven by the fact that real wages have been stagnant for half the population for almost four decades, and that concentration of wealth that you just described. And so there is a realignment. People want the wealthy to pay their share. They don't want to live in a plutocratic society. They'd rather, polls show, Americans would rather live in a society closer to Sweden, where there's a basic, decent safety net, and there isn't this grotesque imbalance of wealth at the top. So I think we are kind of, you know, running up against the sort of the last run at, you know, grabbing more money, taking the money and running, whether it's the fossil fuel industry or whether it's, you know, Wall Street financiers. The party is coming to a close. We just cannot sustain this. And even the ranks of the wealthy now are very clearly split. And you're seeing more and more wealthy people. There's this guy, Peter Jarjescu, who just wrote a book, Capitalists Arise. He's a big Wall Street advertising CEO. He's saying, look, this is completely unsustainable. It's not in anyone's interest to keep going down this path toward economic apartheid. So you're even seeing reasonable Wall Street voices just saying, this is not in anyone's interest to keep going down this road.
So that's a kind of play on the old international anthem of the working class. Arise, ye prisoners of starvation. Arise, ye capitalists.
That's right. It is.
It is. How
he's basically saying to his peers,
yeah,
you know, stagnant wages, collapsing middle class, mm-hmm. growing racial wealth divide. None of those are, you know, you don't want your children and grandchildren, you yourself don't want to live in a society where we're heading. But it's time to be part of intervening and reversing these inequalities.
But the engine that's driving that kind of wealth inequality, where you make money out of money, and frankly, the Koch brothers, who've become incredibly wealthy and extremely politically active, even though they started out with refineries and oil and gas infrastructure, etc., their wealth has multiplied through basically Wall Street, their investments, and playing and, you know, maximizing the kind of trading that goes on, high-speed trading and all this kind of stuff, which also this other billionaire that's extremely influential with the Trump White House, the biggest donor to Trump, Mercer, he's basically a guy that's a brilliant mathematician, and he developed a bunch of algorithms that essentially, use computers to make money out of money. So my question would be, in the broader sense, is if you have a capitalist system that's based on extracting wealth and not creating wealth, which after all, the robber barons, as tough as they were, they did create wealth. They didn't just keep extracting. Is that a dead end that we're heading towards? Can you reach a kind of Rubicon where you're just playing with money, making money out of money, in itself will bring down capitalism?
Well, I think you're right in that it's not sustainable. I mean, there was this phase of even under the robber baron wealth where they were definitely extracting from nature, but at a certain point, the concentration becomes, and we're seeing this in the incredible rate of mergers and acquisitions and corporate consolidation, and you start to see the economy eating its feed corn, the old expression, don't eat your seed corn. That's the capital you need to reinvest for the future, and there's a sort of self cannibalization quality to some of what's happening in the economy. I think that's part of, we've crossed that line, and kind of the real capitalists, the people who actually are kind of interested in making real goods and products and services, are starting to see how the Wall Street financiers are coming to squeeze them now. And they don't want to have any part of it. So you're seeing this break between the predatory, extractive, capitalists, the venture capitalists, the vultures preying on productive enterprises and undermining them, and some pushback from real, locally based businesses who are saying, stop extracting from and nickel and diming us at every turn of the way.
But something's happened, though. It seems to have gone somewhat under the radar, and that is that 10 years ago, you had the companies with the biggest market capitalization were ExxonMobil and Citibank, etc. Now, 10 years later, the biggest companies are Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Microsoft. They all have enormous market capitalization.
Yeah.
The most powerful companies in the world. And they're not considered, as Google's motto is, don't do evil. Well, they're not considered evil. People like Apple products. They don't pollute like the oil companies do, etc. But they still are powerful monopolies. So how do you see them in this overall picture?
Well, I think we're just starting to understand just what does it mean when those actors... Now, clearly, Amazon is kind of in a different category because it is buying up Whole Foods and buying up and kind of putting Main Street retailers out. It's gone beyond books, and it's going to, destroying the retail sector in a lot of small communities where you're better off just ordering it through Amazon. And so you see vast swaths of the local retail sector evaporating. So that's a good example where unfair competition at the top, they're willing to sort of lose money to wipe out whole retail sectors, and then they'll come in and then they'll start making money because they'll jack up their prices. I do think there's now a little bit, it's interesting to see Google kind of pressing down on this liberal think tank, New America Foundation. They after this group of scholars basically said, isn't it great that Europe imposed those fines on Google and the United States should do the same? They threatened to withdraw their funding from this think tank. They forced the layoffs or firings of a number of people. So, but I think that there's going to be a revival of antitrust spirit, that these monopolies are fundamentally anti-competitive. They're actually undermining open markets. So professed capitalists who believe in real competition and open markets are appalled. And you can see it, we're getting nickel and dimed in every way. Beer, the cost of beer. There's two giant duopolies in the beer industry. Cable providers, cell phone providers. The fact that there's not competition costs us money as consumers. It's also destroying Main Street economies. The craft brewery industry has helped revitalize a lot of Main Streets around this country. A lot of small mill towns in New England have thriving new little economic upticks because of that. And the big duopolies in beer are trying to squeeze them out, snuff them out. So I think there's, again, you know, at a certain point, the math just becomes 99-1 or 999-1, you know, out of 1,000.
Right.
And if that's where, you know, we just have to say we're not going to take it anymore. We have to break up these monopolies that are, you know, eventually going to keep squeezing harder, going to keep squeezing the competition.
But just in closing, do you see you described the mill towns being revived by craft breweries. Is that a model on a broader landscape? In other words, you know, people talk about the end of work and deindustrialization and robotics taking over. Is it possible that we could create a kind of society that's more based on bartering and crafts and people's individual talents being transacted?
Well, I think that is one of the ways forward. You know, there's this tremendous new economy movement, the relocalization of food, but also manufacturing and production, beer being just one of those things. But, if you look around New England, there are these emerging new relocalized economies where people are saying, let's produce more of what we need here in the real economy. Let's protect our local economies from the big extractive actors. And let's push back against the monopolies or the Amazons of the world that are hoovering up, you know, the wealth of our communities, and let's keep more of it local. So more and more communities are trying to nail down as much of their commonwealth and commons and creating high road economies. And it's yet to be, you know, well, I think that's one of the ways forward for sure.
Well, Chuck Collins, I thank you very much for joining us on this Labor Day. It's been an interesting discussion, and I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian. Happy Labor Day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Chuck Collins, who's a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he directs IPS's program on inequality and the common good. He's also the co-founder of Wealth for the Common Good and the Patriotic Millionaires. And his books include Wealth and Our Commonwealth, which he co-wrote with Bill Gates Sr. And his latest book is Born on Third Base, A One Percenter Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And he has a new study at the Next System Project, Reversing Inequality, Unleashing the Transformative Potential of an Equitable Economy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back exploring the reasons why union representation in the private sector has shrunk to below 7% compared to 35% in the 1950s.
There's power in a factory, power in the land, power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood, the spikes of the bosses. She's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us on this Labor Day is Sylvia Allegretto, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Silvia Allegretto.
It's good to be back.
And Silvia, let's look at the state of labor. I know we keep hearing these depressing statistics that union representation in the private sector has fallen to below 7% compared to 35% in the 1950s. And there is, I think, no question that the decline of union power is undermining the American dream for a middle-class livelihood. I wish more Americans understood that connection between unions and the standard of living and the building of a middle class, which was made very clear by, you know, the history of the UAW, for example, in Detroit. But just to stick with the issue of that industry, the car industry, we just saw an extraordinary example of union busting going on down at the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi, where the NRLB, the National Labor Relations Board, even though they charged Nissan for breaking the law, threatening workers, etc., using the facilities to play in their factories, anti-union videos inside the plants, organizing efforts with supervisors, grabbing employees one-on-one, you know, foisting anti-union messages on them. The level of intimidation is extraordinary. So is that where the problem is, that there's just no enforcement mechanism in the Labor Department anymore and on the NLRB to really hold these big corporations to account, because they're clearly engaging in coordinated and sophisticated union busting?
Yes, that's definitely part of the problem. And it's certainly when they're actually having a union drive and the workers trying to decide whether they should be represented by a worker or not, these concerted efforts and these illegal, often illegal tactics are ramped up around that situation. And so, you know, the only way that we can have representation and people can make their own decisions is without these tactics, without these scare tactics, and without fear of losing your job, about fear of being punished. But we have to keep in mind that this has been happening for decades. So this concerted effort that we always hear about that ramps up around unions, you know, workers deciding whether to have a union and union votes, it's always under the table. It's always, you know, it's always in the background. And it has been for decades. And that's why I think it's even hard for workers to understand the role, today's workers to understand the role that unions had once had in really building and defining a strong middle class. So you have the idea that workers are scared, but you also have the notion that a lot of workers are actually anti-union, who would be vastly helped by unions. But again, that's not a surprise, because there has been, you know, the undercutting and the constant barrage of anti-union activity that is going out. And again, this is a concerted effort, you know, to make sure that people don't ever want to join unions. But yes, when we talk about the implosion that happened during the Great Recession, when we talk about the ever-increasing inequality, that job quality of employment has been on the decline. You know, all of this ties right back into unionization. And there's no way that we can mitigate, let alone start to undo some of the damage done by workers not having any voice in their workplaces without unions. And that's like any other institution, there are problems, but I don't know why we want to throw out, the one institution that can really help workers in this country. But they've been very successful in convincing a lot of the workforce today that unions actually are part of the problem and not part of the solution. But I think we're having a lot of activity over the last few years. The Fight for 15, which, if you recall, the Fight for 15 was not just for higher minimum wages, but also for the right to unionize. So, you know, there are in some pockets of the country, you know, push for unionization, for the right to unionize. And we definitely need a government and a labor relations board that is strongly enforced. And we need the support of the government to make sure that we have fair elections, which is definitely a heavy lift right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Silvia Allegretta, who is a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. But I think that what's hidden here and not being debated, and it's not just that some union people who want to be would normally want to have a union have been sort of brainwashed or intimidated into this kind of anti-union canard that's out there. I think it's also spread across the rest of the country that there's this belief, and the statistic I mentioned earlier, that we're down to 7% compared to 35% in the 1950s of the work private sector being unionized, is the idea that somehow this is happening because workers just don't want to be in unions. What's missing in this equation is this extraordinary multi-billion dollar union busting industry, where you've got people like the Koch brothers, you've got the Club for Growth. Millions, billions are being spent and have been spent over the decades to brainwash us all into believing that this is the case. And they're very sophisticated. It's not like the Pinkerton goons back in the early 20th century used to shoot union organizers. These are guys that, you know, come up from Wall Street with their button-down suits, and they're very sophisticated. And
That's exactly what I was kind of getting at, that we have a whole institution that is built up around union busting. And there are firms, law firms, that do nothing but make sure that unions have a bad name and make sure that bargaining contracts are never passed. And so I think you're hitting the nail on the head there. But I'll say again, there is no coming back to a strong middle class that is sorely needed in this country without a collective voice of workers.
Well, but doesn't the new Supreme Court justice come from one of these union-busting firms? I mean, he's famous for the truck driver, the frozen truck driver, who was expected to die in his rig rather than seek shelter, and they found against him. That sort of made Gorsuch's bones. He got noticed because he made that ruling, you know, where I think seven other judges sided with the truck driver who had no choice. He either freeze to death or go seek help. And abandoning his rig in Gorsuch's world is a crime, not a crime, but is something that should be punished for. Now, this guy's on the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court are about to hear this Friedrichs case coming out of California that could basically take away the funding for public employee unions in terms of their political support for the Democratic Party.
Well, look, first of all, the fact that the Labor Department just recently inducted Ronald Reagan, one might say at the height of some hypocrisy, into the Labor Hall of Honor is quite stunning. I mean, this is, again, this is the long-term effect of what you're talking about. You know, when Reagan crushed the air traffic controllers back in the early 1980s, this really, started the more modern anti-labor movement. But yes, right now we're looking at this Friedrichs case that basically is going to, if it passes, destroy what is left of really the unionization, which is the public sector. Still about one-third of public sector workers, mostly in healthcare and education, are unionized. And they know these anti-union labor-busting entities know that if we can get rid of the public sector unions, they've basically wiped out unions in the United States. So yes, if Friedrichs would pass at the Supreme Court level, we would basically wipe out unions as we know it, even the unions that we have, the relatively strong unions in some cases in the public sector, they would be severely, severely weakened. And then I'm not sure what happens because, look, thank goodness we do have the public sector unions, because unions still do help to set, you know, some of the policies, even in the private sector, with some spillover effects. Of course, that becomes less and less as unions become less powerful. But when you look at the degree of inequality, when you look at the unbalanced nature that of the economy that we're living in right now, and how workers are certainly not getting their fair share, when corporate profits are skyrocketing, all of these things just keep getting worse as labor and union density gets weaker. So as Friedrichs goes, I think you're going to see a real hammering of the middle class and just ever-increasing inequality. And as our workers become more productive, as our workers increase the economic pie greatly, which has happened even over the last 30 or 40 years, they are going to be getting a less and a less share of their labor. And that's just what has been happening, and that would ratchet up greatly with the passage of Friedrichs.
But do you see a kind of theme here, if you will, or a strategy? It would seem to me that Mitch McConnell preventing the seating of Obama's choice for the Supreme Court to replace Scalia, about a year of hardball, and then they bring in this anti-labor guy who made his bones ruling against the frozen truck driver and got the attention of the Federalist Society and all of this. This is Gorsuch, which is so far Donald Trump's biggest achievement as far as the conservatives in this country are concerned. It seems like the conservatives know what they want. They're very strategic about the Supreme Court. And they take it really seriously, and nobody in these ridiculously theatrical hearings that go on in the Senate, these confirmation hearings where these people, these candidates for the Supreme Court, don't say a damn thing. One of the questions that's never asked is, are you a corporatist? You know, and we got all these pro-corporatist people on the Supreme Court now, with Gorsuch perhaps creating the majority. To my mind, that's where the rubber meets the road.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, again, going to just make the situations all the worse. And, you know, we need some real progressives in government. And, you know, it's not even just at the federal level. I mean, what's happening at the state level is really disconcerting, too, with all these preemption laws. So there are a lot of places, a lot of cities and counties, for instance, in passing minimum wage increases. Like in St. Louis, they passed a minimum wage increase to go to $10 an hour. In the city of St. Louis. And then the state decides, no, we're going to pass preemption that says no local governments can have minimum wages higher than the state level. So they actually instituted these increases up to $10 an hour for workers in the city of St. Louis, and they were rolled back to $7.70 an hour after the state passed preemption. This has also happened in Kentucky, where Louisville and Lexington passed higher minimum wages, and then they were undone by most of the states. So many of the states now are run by Republican governors. And these preemption laws are for minimum wages and fair scheduling and paid sick leave, making sure that the, you know, places where they might be more progressive in some of these cities, even in the South now, who the areas where we've never seen minimum wage increases above the federal level, they seem to be one step ahead and they're undoing them, which is really quite unbelievable because it's so anti-democratic. But yes, at all levels of government, you know, we see this kind of anti-worker, anti-union sentiment.
Well, I think you're seeing it down, the results of it down in Texas with these floods, where the poorer people don't have insurance. The flood, of course, also affected wealthy neighborhoods, but they'll recover. And these poorer people down there live in suburbs right up against toxic chemical and oil and gas plants in called the Chemical Coast, or otherwise known locally as Cancer Alley. you see it all there, and you see the whole state of Texas run by these Republicans, many of whom, for example, the governor himself is a devout Christian, but he's he was bought by the Koch brothers to basically, after a whole huge explosion, wiped out a nursing home, killing 15 people because the fertilizer plant exploded. The first thing that Abbott did running for as Attorney General, running for governor, was take money from the Koch brothers. And then instead of reform, they rescinded the requirement for companies in Texas to publicly produce an inventory of hazardous materials that they have on plant sites. And now we see this plant in Crosby, this chemical plant, on fire, spreading incredibly toxic fumes. So to my mind, it's extraordinary that you have these politicians at the state level who are clearly dedicated to corporate profits over people's lives. That's their priority.
Well, that is clearly coming out of the stories in Texas. I think a lot of us in the rest of the country are, it's a big learning moment, because people even that I've been talking to recently are just kind of dumbfounded by the lack of public policy and zoning. There's absolutely no zoning restrictions, I guess, in Texas, from what we're finding out. And the fact that you can have schools and nursing homes right up against, you know, very toxic chemical plants in neighborhoods. There simply was no zoning. This is a lack of public policy that is unfathomable. But this is what happens when you have a corporatist states, and more so even in the nation. Again, turning away from workers, families, and communities, and doing what's best for the majority of us, because you are basically selling out to corporate America. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about Texas and what was happened, how it was planned, how there was no zoning, how there was no thought about regulating any type of growth as far as, you know, when the dams were built. And now people live basically right on top of those dams. And those types of stories will definitely be coming out in the coming months regarding Texas.
And meanwhile, the state of Texas is trying to woo corporations from California to move down, with the lure being, you know, you can have unlimited profits, no regulation, and we don't care about the public's health and welfare.
Well, and also they'll give them massive tax breaks. It's
right,
the cannibals.
Exactly. They gave $8.7 billion to this French chemical company that's now on fire, the one that's right in the middle of a suburb in Crosby, Texas. That company has received $8.7 billion in tax breaks from the state of Texas.
Yeah, this idea of corporate welfare, which is running rampant in the country, but we hear so much less about it. It's really amazing. And again, you have very strong lobbyists, right? You have the chemical lobby, you have the gas and oil lobby. And, you know, by any other name, these lobbies are unions. These are industry specific often, and they pull their money together. That's why you have like the banking lobby. Then all the banks pull their money together. They send representation to Washington, D.C. to lobby for their interests. And I find it really quite ironic, because in my mind, well, that seems loosely like a union. They're a union that has certain interests in mind. They're willing to pay together as a group to make sure that those interests are represented at the tops of our government, from, you know, at state and federal levels. And I wish that the workers would understand that that's happening, and that they can do and should do the same thing to make sure that their voices are heard.
Well, Sylvia Allegretto, I thank you for joining us here on this Labor Day. I appreciate the conversation.
Well, it's always nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Sylvia. And again, I've been speaking with Sylvia Allegretta, who's a labor economist and co-chair of the Center on Wage and Employment Dynamics at the University of California, Berkeley. She has co-authored several editions of The State of Working America, and her research interests include long-term unemployment, family budgets, teacher pay, public employee compensation, low-wage labor markets, inequality, and minimum wages. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a veteran labor journalist and author of The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where every time if you catch all of the rays. All of our working days are done, but a time if you were having all of the fun. Get used to the dust. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sam Pizzagatti, who's a veteran labor journalist and an editor of the online newsletter inequality.org. His latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. And he has an article at inequality.org, A Hall of Fame Turns Shameful. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Pizzagatti.
Thank you very much.
And the Hall of Fame turning shameful, is that's in a reference to the Labor Department putting up Ronald Reagan in the Hall of Fame?
Yes. The U.S. Labor Department, Department of Labor, has a Hall of Honor. And they created this Hall of Fame back in 1988, and it has real heroes in it, people like Cesar Chavez, the legendary farm worker organizer, and Tony Mazzocchi, who was the moving force behind federal worker safety protections. But this Hall of Fame, Hall of Honor, the Labor Department has just inducted its newest member, and that's Ronald Reagan, the biggest union buster in American history.
And that would be because you have one of Trump's people in there, Acosta, right?
Who's Alexandra Acosta is the current U.S. Secretary of Labor, and under him, the Labor Department is doing a number of things to undercut working people in the United States and the protections that have been won over the generations.
So that's the same as like the putting the anti-environmentalist Scott Pruitt in charge of the EPA, etc. This is the strategy of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank.
That's right. And Dracula is certainly what we have at the Department of Labor right now.
So on this Labor Day, then, is there any, you know, we keep repeating the statistic that we're below 7% of private sector is unionized. It used to be 35% in 1950. We know that unions create the middle class. We know that the country's becoming more of a plutocracy, less of a democracy, that the 1% or the 1/10 of 1% have the wealth equivalent to 90% of the rest of us. So it's just shocking what's happening. What's your sense of, and I also have to add to that, that the Supreme Court, now that they've got an anti-union corporatist on there, Neil Gorsuch, who's famously ruled against the frozen truck driver who was expected to die and was punished for leaving his rig to save his life by Gorsuch. They're likely to overturn the Friedrichs case and basically kill off the public sector unions in this country. So can you give us some hope here, Sam, that there's some way to turn this anti-union juggernaut around?
Well, I think it can. Certainly, if you look by conventional measures, the labor movement in the United States is at its darkest hour in close to a century. You mentioned before the percent of workers of Americans in union, that's gone down to 6.7% in the private sector. In a state like South Carolina, less than 1% of workers in South Carolina belong to unions. So across broad swatches of the country, the labor movement has essentially disappeared. So that's the dark story. That's the dire story. But I think we need to remember, you know, that old saying that it's always darkest before the dawn. And when we look back historically at the at the 1930s, a time of great labor mobilization, we need to remember that in 1929, 1930, 1931, the labor movement was exactly where it is today, and that is almost non-existent in many parts of the country. And yet a half a dozen years later, labor was everywhere, and there was a mass organizing movement all across the country, and millions of people became an active part of the labor movement. So the question is, can we repeat that? Are there any signs that we have today that we're about to repeat that? And I think that there are some signs. There are different forms of labor organizing, you know, starting to take shape across the country. Things like worker centers, which aren't exactly unions, but they do reflect working people getting together. So we have like organizations like the National Domestic Workers Alliance, which was able to win the nation's first domestic workers' Bill of Rights in New York, the Bill of Rights that established overtime pay and sexual harassment protection and paid time off for domestic workers. We have the Restaurant Opportunities Center, an organization which has been using street protests and legal actions and legislative lobbying to advance agenda to protect restaurant workers. And we have the whole campaign for $15 minimum wage, which is has had a number of successes in cities, and now starting to have those successes on the state level as well. So I think if we look beyond the conventional union measurement terms, there is motion out there, there is activity, and there is cause for hope.
And at a psychological level, what can be done to reverse this notion that American workers don't like unions, when what's really going on is this incredibly multi-billion-dollar funded union-busting organization funded by the Koch brothers and other billionaires that has been so effective? And as I mentioned, the Supreme Court is now may well have an anti-union pro-corporatist majority that will eviscerate. In other words, can we at a psychological level get across the simple equation that the more unionization you have, the stronger the American middle class is, and everybody has to notice that the middle class is being shredded, working people are living paycheck to paycheck, while the 1% are just getting fatter and fatter and greedier and greedier, and the 0.1% have an obscene amount of wealth equivalent to 90% of the entire combined wealth of the rest of us?
Well, I think the best way to change that perception, to create a more accurate perception, the best way is to win some victories. And let me point to two. One I've already mentioned, the struggle for $15 an hour minimum wage. Victories there, led by these new labor organizations in conjunction with traditional labor organizations, are a key part of changing the perception of worker organizing around the United States. But let me mention another struggle, which has gotten much less attention, which I think has a great deal of potential, and that's the struggle around pay ratios. This past December, the city of Portland, Oregon, established a new tax on businesses that pay their top executives over 25 times what they pay their lowest paid workers. And this idea of setting, leveraging the public purse against corporations that overpay their executives compared to their workers is starting to catch on all across the country. And this coming spring, for the first time ever, major corporations in the United States will have to publicly reveal the ratio between their CEO pay and the pay of their most typical workers. So there'll be an official ratio published for all the major corporations in the United States. And I think this is going to be a spur to all sorts of activities, like the activity we saw in Portland that produced that new business tax. So I'm very excited about that. I think we have a big opportunity to link the struggle against excessive CEO pay to the struggle to wage wages for America's workers.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Sam Pizzagatti, on this Labor Day, what do you think it would take then to kind of reinvent or reestablish a kind of an egalitarian spirit that in many ways the country was founded on, the land of opportunity, a meritocracy, if you will? It's clearly becoming a plutocracy. And inherited wealth is more prevalent than the possibility of pulling your stuff up by the bootstraps. So, there's less equality and less opportunity. Can we reinvent the American dream and call out this nonsense and call for the country to be more aligned with its own mythology?
Well, I think we can, and I say that because we already have. Now, in the beginning of the 1900s, we faced a plutocracy that was even more plutocratic than the situation we have now. Yet by the middle of the 20th century, we were able to overcome it and create a much more equal United States. And if we did that then, why can't we do that now? And I think the key back a century ago is that progressives were able to establish the notion that if we want to have a decent country in the United States, we have to do two things. We have to level up people at the bottom and level down people at the top, the rich people at the top. And if we do both things, we can create a more equal America. And we know that that equal societies simply work better than more unequal societies.
Well, Sam Pizzagatti, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, who is a veteran labor journalist and an editor of the online newsletter inequality.org. His latest book is The Rich Don't Always Win, The Forgotten Triumph Over Plutocracy That Created the American Middle Class. And he has an article at inequality.org, A Hall of Fame Turns Shameful. This has been a special Labor Day edition of Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm